nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. I roamed these halls some 20 years ago, but I never gave a talk here, so it's kind of cool. So I'm going to focus mostly on the research I do in my group, which is atomistic modeling, and I'm going to motivate it basically with a history of the modeling I've done at Texas Instruments and at NASA to give you ideas where we're going with this material. So obviously I didn't do this by myself, so I have a research group here now. I had a research group at NASA JPL, and I was part of a group at Texas Instruments. And then there's a whole other technical group of people that are in the NanoHub and the HubZero team. Since I'm an electrical engineer, I'm perfectly eligible to show you Moore's Law. And what I want to remind you is that he really talked about manufacturing costs versus number of components. This has somewhat become a self-fulfilling prophecy. We might look at this normally in this, where we say, as a number of years, the number of transistors on a chip has basically grown exponentially, and we have now 2 billion transistors on a chip. Well, that's a pretty amazing thing if you think about engineering, of putting 2 billion things that actually work together in a coherent way, that actually works. There's another way of looking at Moore's Law. Yeah. Actually, I would prefer if you could hold your question to the end because we're videotaping it. Well, jot it down, take a note. So here is a chart of power density versus number of years, and you sort of see how it got converted from junction transistors into CMOS, and now we're climbing up in temperature in terms of power density per watt square centimeter. And we're reaching the point of sort of a nuclear reactor heat density. So you're not going to make it chips much hotter, which means they're not going to get faster anymore. And that's actually true for the last 3 years, 4 years. Chips have not gotten faster. They're pegged at 2.3 gigahertz or something like that, and that's it. So something else is happening. This is a chart I love to show, even though it's old. And actually, I like to show it because it's old. It's by Robert Chow. He is a TI fellow. The chart is from 2004, so 6 years old. And this was their agenda. And the cool thing to show about this is that they said in 2009 they will have a 32 nanometer node that was 5 years ahead of the ahead, like looking ahead. And guess what? Last year, in 2009, they released a 32 nanometer node. The point is, industry has a trajectory that they work for and that they work on. And the fact is now, looking down 5-6 years down the road, they don't know what technologies are coming online. So they are seeing Moore's Law to come to an end to a certain degree, because it's not clear what technologies are going to replace the current CMOS technology. Also, I'd like to show this in the sense that I have a couple of observations. There's 3D spatial variations on the nanometer scale. So it's no longer the planar field effect transistor, but these things almost look like X-rays of teeth, right? I mean, there's three-dimensional geometries to it. There's new materials in there. And there you have potential, electrostatic potential variations on the nanometer scale. No longer on the macro scale like microns, but on the nanometer scale. And they look even at new channel materials. They have used germanium and silicon germanium, and they're also looking into 3.5s now. And the question and challenges there are, how important is strain, quantization, crystal orientations? The atoms you have now in these devices are countable. Does it matter? Does the granularity matter? And really the question you need to ask is this a new material or is this a new device? We're really meeting at this front of putting together a new material or a new device, and it's actually both. And what I'd like to assert to begin with is that high bias is important, non-equilibrium is important, you need to do quantum mechanics on these devices, and I believe it's critical that you do an atomistic representation. And I will try to motivate that in the beginning part of my presentation now, why I believe this atomistic representation is important, And I will show you a bunch of results that I think validate that. So when we're talking about transport far from equilibrium, if you come from a large dimensions, we think of diffusive electron transport or maybe ballistic transport and down to quantum transport, and we think of drift diffusion and Boltzmann. But if you have a quantum mechanical system, physicists would love to write down a Hamiltonian, right, and you deal with a law of equilibrium. You even might get fancy and attach some self-energies that do some corrections to something. But really, as an electrical engineer, I have something like this. I'm attaching batteries to the left and the right of a device, and I need to shuttle electrons through that system. And that is a non-equilibrium problem. In fact, maybe at Purdue in physics, you might offer this as a course, right? It's non-equilibrium quantum statistical mechanics, somehow at the 600 level, right? It's sort of the ultimate you might study. But that's the day-to-day business that our nano devices operate in. All right, so the formalism we use for describing this is in non-equilibrium green functions. You can rederive Boltzmann and drift diffusion out of that, and it really delivers a unified model. And in this unified model, you can look at very different devices, chunks of silicon, carbon nanotubes, molecules. The fundamental mechanism in which you treat that does not change. It's just the basis functions that you choose are changing. All right, so as a motivator, the industry is driven by a revenue stream, right? They want you to throw your computer away every 3 years or 4 years, right? And unless there is an advancement, you're not going to do that. These devices are on a nanometer scale. You can count the atoms. And I can assure you that there is no tools out there that fundamentally are quantum mechanics based. Typically, quantum mechanics are patched into TCAD tools, into tools that engineers use today. And the tools that do exist don't even know that there is an atomistic granularity under the hood. They assume that matter is continuous. And finally, these devices get way too hot, and you got to create alternative designs and think about different methodologies of doing transistors. So the goal really is that we build a tool suite that we started out calling NEMO. That was the work at TI, and now we're doing it one more time, so we call it OMEN, which is NEMO backwards. So we're building a tool suite that can try to address these problems. So obviously this is a condensed matter seminar here, so I don't have to remind you too hard about condensed matter physics, but really quantum mechanics was sort of identified or invented around isolated atoms with discrete transitions, and then we pack them together and we get them in regularly ordered atoms, and we think in terms of transport, connectivity, and mobility. And that's how quantum mechanics is typically buried in these concepts here of mobility and effective mass and bands. But really the question is, what does it really mean for electrons to move freely? And what I like to motivate here is that crystals have certain symmetries, and it's by any means not clear that these electrons should move in the same direction with the same electronic properties. Also, the basis functions that are under the hood are nothing but spherically symmetric, so there should be some effects there. And the question is really, what does free mean? And at least in electrical engineering, when we take a semiconductor course, somebody talks very fast about Schrödinger's equation and some ansatz about plane waves, and then they show you a dispersion that might look like this, an EK diagram. And they say it's very hard to compute and you can't get your hands on that. Oops. And typically what we do as electrical engineers is we assume, well, this is a complicated band edge. We're just going to put a parabola on here. And we do that same thing also for the holes. And we typically forget that these bands are coupled. And we throw that out and just deal with these effective mass approximations. And then people say that everything is described by a conduction band, by an effective mass, maybe some mobility, and you build drift diffusion simulators, you build Boltzmann transport simulators, and you build even most of the quantum simulators are based on that, where these few parameters are really the input. That's it. There's no atomistics under the hood. And what I would claim is that these things will fail when the bands are coupled, when you have variations on the nanometer scale. And when you do band-to-band type devices.
Would you keep bands that coupled in something like that, just on parallelicity?
When they're coupled due to heterostructures, for example, when a translational symmetry is broken, when you start to mix bands, etc.
But those bands, when you show that, those are a result of base structure calculation. They're not coupled.
I'll show you. Okay. I'll show you. All right. So here's the outline of my presentation. And I love this quote here from Kadanov in a paper from 2004 where he said, "Excellent computer simulations are done for a purpose. The most valid purposes are to explore uncharted territory, to resolve well-posed scientific or technical questions, or to make a good design choice." And I'm going to add one more, to educate and train. And those are the points I like to make in my presentation. So the question I want to raise is, can the peak-to-valley ratio in RTDs be increased, and what's the origin of the valley current? And what are design alternatives? And can you do a million atom electronic structure calculation, and would it even matter? And can we simulate transport in such structures? And finally, can online simulation enhance learning and research? So those are the points I'd like to touch base on, given on the backdrop that I just gave you. If you don't know what a resonant tunneling diode is, here's a very simple picture. It's a double barrier structure. You might have a resonance in there. And as you crank up a voltage here, you apply voltage, you pull the sea of electrons down in the collector, you pull this resonance into the sea of electrons on the emitter, the current will rise. As you increase the voltage further, there is no supply function on the left here. The resonance is under the sea of electrons, no supply, the current goes down. And eventually, as you increase the bias further, you will start to tunnel through excited states or through thermionic emission. So that's sort of what I would call a Mickey Mouse description of a resonant tunneling diode. What I'm showing you on the right here is a black line is the prediction before experiment. And on the green dots are 12 different devices on two different wafers and three different mesa sizes and two different bias directions. And that was experiment in 1997. And
why is it called a diode?
It's a two-terminal device. That's one part of it.
A wire.
Yeah, it could be a wire. That's true.
I think of diode as it's coming differently in different directions.
Yeah, and that could be introduced by different asymmetries in the device. But I don't know why actually they call it a diode. That was a question I never was asked. The field calls it a resonant tunneling diode. So in 1994, the best experimental peak to valley ratio, the ratio between the peak and the valley was about 80. And to make this useful, it had to be 1,000, at least. And the fundamental question is, what is this valley current and where does it come from? And in 1997, we were able to basically overlap theory and experiment and even predict experiment. So I'm going to try to answer some of the fundamentals of the key insights that we gained. So to give you a reference, everybody and their brother in that time had a Poisson Schrodinger solver based on effective mass, because you can put that together rather easily. People worked on density functions. They worked on Wigner functions. There were a few people here, including at Purdue, that worked on this NEGF formalism. And the key insight where everybody in the field would agree is that the valley current here would be due to scattering. Electrons come in at a high energy. They're not allowed in that state anymore because there's no supply function in the bottom. They come in, emit a phonon, and come out. Everybody would agree that that is the source of valley current. And what I'd like to convince you of is that high-performance RTDs are not that way, and that there's other mechanisms that are really need to be considered. And the other limitations were you had a tiny device simulation domain, so these Mickey Mouse devices, no extended contacts, no realistic scattering models, and the computation at time was too expensive for engineering. One thing I learned at TI, what they told me is, well, if you take a month to simulate it, I can build it, test it, and characterize it in less than a month. So get out. And there was no predictive theory modeling and simulation. You can fit some curves for one device, but you'd have to fit it for another device after that. So really, the key insight I'm going to tell you up front, and then I try to justify it later, was this, that in order to connect these concepts to real engineering, what we had to do is start from these Mickey Mouse diagrams, but put the atoms back in place and put the potentials back in place and resolve it. We chose an atomistic basis set where literally each atomic layer was explicitly resolved in the device. That is sort of equivalent to a multiband model. And going back to the question, these bands are the translational symmetry is broken, therefore these bands are coupled in heterostructures like that. And that's a key element that is needed. And really, what you have is something that you should consider like a new material, because these spatial variations are within 5 nanometers, right? Typical devices, 5 nanometers, 5 nanometers, 5 nanometers, barrier, well, barrier, ballpark. All right. So let me tell you some of the key insights that you need. So if you here's your man-made resonator, a double barrier structure of length L. And here is an EK diagram assumed to be parabolic. So I can quantize this in the transport direction as my ground state as pi over L, right? So at least analytically, I could say I'm going to read off the equivalent pi over L in my dispersion. And I look over here and that's where my ground state is. My excited state should be twice the K. So I double my K and I read it off like this. But most of the materials that we dealt with in the experiments were rather non-parabolic. So they are not parabolic like the red line here, but they start to curve off. So the ground state roughly projects to the same K point or energy point. But the excited state really is happening at a much lower energy. And it can be as low as 100 millielectron volt. That's 4 KT. And you put that into an exponent, you suddenly have a lot of carriers that are lingering around at that energy. So that really means the second diode turn on over here that in single band would almost give you no current whatsoever, gives you very strong current in a multiband model. And you can say it's even so bad you have to put it on an exponential scale, like 3 orders of magnitude wrong current. So that's one of the key elements, that the effective mass by default would always give you a too low a valley current, but even just by putting in this non-parabolicity, you get more. But then you still say, well, but what's up here, right? There's a difference on the peak. I argued that this resonance here, the ground state, has roughly the same energy, but I'm missing something. So what am I missing? The current in the multiband is basically a factor of 10 or 6 bigger. So there's another thing that's missing. So we're looking at transmission as a simple example of transmission through a single barrier. So I'm injecting into the evanescent state of a barrier material. So let me look at that. So you have my propagating state above the barrier, and in a single band effective mass model, I actually have a parabolic attenuation constant as well, right? So every textbook has tunneling through a single barrier. But if you have a valence band really, I can read off my attenuation constant, so to speak, at which my exponential wave function is going to decay. But in reality, I have a conduction and a valence band, and they're coupled. And here's the line. You can barely read it. I don't know why it's not showing on this computer. So there's a line that's running right here. And you can see at the same energy, my attenuation constant that I would read off in my analytical model is much smaller. Okay? That means the decay rate is much smaller. That means your barrier is much more transparent than you think it is. Okay? So your shutoff of the current or your attenuation of the currents is much weaker than you think it is. And that basically raises the current up by a couple more factors. Right? So there's a couple other effects you can line out as well. But at the end, we build test matrices at TI where we can predictively overlay experiment and theory and follow it over several orders of magnitude and follow the trends in the experiment in peak and valley. Even when you make structures asymmetric, we have charging, we have contacts. I mean, going over that is a lecture by itself. What I want to assure you is that basically in 97, we had a predictive simulator for 3-5 resonant tunneling diodes. And we can build them in the experiment and we can predict the experiment. So So scattering inside the RTD was only important at low temperatures. I didn't show that here. It's not important at room temperatures. Scattering inside the extended context was of critical importance. I didn't talk a lot about that here. Charge self-consistency was critical everywhere, contacts and the central device. And really the key element was that you had to have a band structure that had important featured effects like non-parabolicity, band coupling, and also X and gamma bands, etc. And Negev was the first time the baseline of an industrial strength simulator at the time. And it was available and being used for analysis and design. So really, one question that was well posed was, no, it's not scattering, but thermionic emission that created the valley current, and there's no way around it, at least for these classes of devices. So the next question is, can you do something about it? Can you come up with design alternatives that actually do something about it and learn from it? So you could design devices that are aware of the high valley current, and you design them such that you overall lower the current density. So you introduce 5 different barriers, and then you can build a memory cell and you can implement it. And then we generated 2 US patents with that kind of design for a tunneling memory cell that could be accompanied by a logic circuit. So that's really fast. It's just a point that once you have a design tool, you can actually answer good design choice questions. So then I changed my job from TI to JPL, and we learned a couple of things about tight binding and electronic structure. And I want to address some of these issues. Why would you care about a million atom electronic structure calculation, and will it matter? So here's the modeling agenda. We wanted to model quantum dots. We knew that we will have spatial variations on the nanometer scale, and we wanted to map that onto an atomistic structure. And we knew we wanted to do it quantum mechanically. And there's really a couple of choices you can do if you want to do it atomistically. You can do pseudopotentials or local orbitals. And I know pseudopotentials are very popular in the physics community, but I'm an electrical engineer, and my devices have an end. They have a terminal on the left and the right, and they're not infinitely periodic. And infinitely periodic is great for pseudopotentials, but local orbitals are wonderful for finite size devices. So that's what we chose. Also, we are interested in stable semiconductors. We're not interested in the establishment of bonds. In fact, if there's a bond flopping back and forth, it's probably a bad device. So I don't need to do the ab initio calculations of the establishment of bonds. I can assume that there is a bond, and I take a model that has it in it. And we use tight binding, and then we can do a million atom type calculation if we immediately build in a parallel approach to computing it. So we use this empirical tight binding, which has a bad name for good reasons. Part of the reason is there's usually bad parameterization, so we spend a lot of time parameterizing bulk materials, silicon, germanium, the 3-5 family. And all on these parameterizations, I'll show you results later. And then at Purdue, when I came here, we were able to demonstrate that we can do a 52 million atom electronic structure calculation. So that corresponds to 100 by 100 by 100 nanometers. So you can put a modern field effect transistor into the simulation domain and actually look at the electronic structure of that. And you can do this for quantum dots, nanowires, for quantum computing, those kind of things. All right. The topology of the simulator is such that, number one, you can't read this here. This says geometry construction for a million atoms. We calculate strain, and then we do valence electron calculations, typically around 10 million atoms, and then we do electron-electron interactions for a few states afterwards. We use a valence force field method for this stage here. Then we use empirical tight binding or maybe piezoelectric effects at polarization charge densities at this level. And then we do self-consistent potentials, or we do Slater determinants for many-body interactions based on the single electron states. What comes out of these VFF calculations, for example, is if you take a material like indium gallium arsenide and you look at the bond distributions in there, you find that it's bimodal. This material is not smooth. It doesn't just mix. If you have indium gallium arsenide and you vary the indium concentration, these lines, these black lines are actually experiment, They are bimodal. That means the indium atoms surround their arsenic neighbors at a much larger distance than the gallium atoms. So there's actually two type of modes of bonds in there. It's not a smooth material. I will show you some result where we basically can look at the optical properties of quantum dots, and then I'll also show you how we can do many-body interactions and single electron effects, like Coulomb blockade type effects in single impurities. So just as a reminder, how do you get these quantum dots? These are typically self-assembled quantum dots we looked at. You have a gallium arsenide material. You grow indium arsenide on top. And you can do that for a few monolayers, and effectively the indium arsenide sort of has to stretch like this. If you try to put on more, it starts to clump up like this, and then you overgrow it with gallium arsenide. And then you have, at least in a pictorial sense, you have monolayers of indium arsenide and then little clumps of indium arsenide as quantum dots. And these things here in the middle might have a million atoms or half a million atoms, so not just three. In this experiment that I'm going to show you is what people have done to modify the optical emission on these things is they overgrew these quantum dots not only with gallium arsenide but indium aluminum arsenide or indium gallium arsenide. And we model that with an atomistically disordered system. And effectively what kind of happens here is if you place in more indium here or in this gallium arsenide matrix, you can sort of see that these guys are starting to push against this quantum dot in the middle. So at least in an intuitive sense, you can see that this quantum dot might actually change shape and get a little bit taller. And that's exactly what happens, and which is a key element in this result that I'm going to show you. So the overgrowth of indium gallium arsenide actually changes the shape of the dots and it changes the emission wavelength. So here's now the result. These are experiments. There's 17 experimental data points on here, all in this black line, right? Meaning these black dots are all different experimental sets of different quantum dots overgrown with indium gallium arsenide at different indium concentrations, right? Taken from a publication here. So again, different experiments. And then we take this geometry as they describe in the experiment with certain uncertainties, of course, and we set it in the simulator, and for some amazing reason, we overlap experiments very, very nicely. We get the right wavelength, and we get this non-linear behavior here that they see in the experiment. And this non-linearity comes due to this change in this quantum dot aspect ratio, and it comes due to this bimodal indium arsenide, gallium arsenide bond distribution. The point is, this material is neither smooth nor is it homogeneous in terms of its bonds. And that is of critical importance to get a result like that. If we turn off some of these effects, we don't get the wavelength and we don't get this nonlinear behavior. All right, and the key element here is also we didn't change any of the previously published tight binding or VFF parameters. It's not like we tweaked them until it works. All right, then people are interested in valley splitting in silicon for quantum computing, and people are able to build very, very thin quantum wells. So here's an example from IEDM. I want to just remind you, obviously you know this on the single particle in a box problem. You solve Schrödinger's equation, you do that in a parabolic band, you get the quantization as I stepped through earlier. What you have is two propagating states, right? They're counter-propagating and they build one bound state. So you get a nice envelope like this. So nothing new there. The key to remember is that the eigenenergies scale as 1 over L square, where L is the quantization length here. And that you have two counterpropagating states forming one bound state and the energy scale as 1 over L square. Now silicon is a little bit more complicated. It doesn't have just one band. You have 6 of those. And due to strain, you can push 4 of them away. If you grow this material on, say, silicon germanium, you can push 4 of these valleys out, but you still are left with 2. So here you quantize again, but now you have 2 valleys and 4 propagating states. And that gives you 2 bound states. And these 2 bound states have an envelope that looks like this. But there's very fast oscillations in those, in this envelope that are determined by the minimum point here of these valleys. So basically, the heterostructure here breaks the symmetry. These two states split, and that is what's called valley splitting. And the cool thing is, if you do this in an atomistic model, where this falls out for free, you don't stick in this valley splitting. You have a quantum mechanical system. You have a Hamiltonian. These valleys are coupled automatically by breaking the translational symmetry. The key element to take away here is the envelope is determined by the quantization length, but the valley splitting is going to be very, very strongly dependent on the atomic overlap at the interface. So the interface will play a role. All right, so this is an early calculation, something like 2002. What we've done is taking a quantum well like this and make it thicker and thicker and trace the valley splitting like this. And it's strongly oscillatory. And for very small number of monolayers, the valley splitting can be huge. It's like tens of millielectron volts. Okay, so the splitting can be big, which was really good news for quantum computing because you want to separate the ground state from the excited state so you don't have decoherence. So we sort of understood this and thought it was great. And you can explain it. Basically, you have these valleys, they interact, they split, and you have this dispersion. And the bad thing is that these guys then actually do experiments, and they found that the valley splitting we predicted was two orders of magnitude too large. They couldn't see it in the experiment. So we're like, something went wrong, right? And the experiment really was two orders of magnitude smaller than what we had predicted. And they also published then this curve along where it indicated that they grow the silicon on silicon germanium on a slanted wafer. It wasn't a flat wafer. It actually had a 2-degree slant. And interestingly enough, these slants are such that one step is smooth, another is rough, then the next one is smooth, and then rough. Okay, so this wafer is actually not flat. So there's some disorder there. So then the question is, does that disorder matter? So if we take a perfect silicon freestanding slab, not even considering the silicon germanium underneath, and calculate the electronic structure in a slab like that, we can also get valley splitting, but it's too small by an order of magnitude. Okay, so something is still missing. So then we can put these ridges on there and we can disorder them. And we can get closer and get, with a step disorder, we get closer to experiment, and there's error bars now because we have many simulations. The next thing is you can say, well, silicon germanium is actually an alloy. It's actually disordered. It's not smooth, right? It's not just bulk or so. At least on the nanometer scale, it looks like a Swiss cheese, right? So there's silicon, and then they see the red atoms here are a germanium. So if you don't have roughness and just put in alloy disorder, you can also increase your valley splitting to something more substantial. And guess what? If you put it all together, the disorder in the alloy and the disorder in the steps, we can actually get very close to experiment. And this is another example where here we didn't adjust any parameters. It's just we took the silicon and germanium potentials we had determined before. We assumed different distributions of step disorder. And we put in 25% of germanium into the silicon germanium randomly, and we overlap experiment very nicely.
So that's a free program. I mean, if you don't know the step disorder.
We're adding it. Yeah, sure. So we took like 100 samples, right? So we did 100 different samples of this.
Degree of freedom too.
I mean, this is the error bar, right? This is the error bar we have. If we just do it alone. But my point is, I find it surprising that we overlap this thing so nicely. But the cool thing is that it shows you need the disorder on two fronts. You need it in the steps, and you need it in the atomistic disorder of the alloy, and it matters. And if you had a smooth model, I'm sure you can fit and push this up somehow, right? But the point is it comes out for free if you actually have a simulation engine like that. All right, so the key elements to take away are that in valley splitting, there's a phase control, and the interface is really determining the interaction and the valley splitting. The last item I'd like to highlight on the electronic structure calculations are that there were some beautiful experiments at the Delft group where they looked at transistors. They cooled them down. They had six different transistors. And for each of the six different ones, they saw fingerprint-like indications of Coulomb blockade diamonds. And every time the Coulomb blockade diamond was slightly different, and they saw excited states in these Coulomb blockade diamonds as well. And what we did is basically model phosphor impurities in silicon at certain distances away from the interface at different electric fields, and we can help them understand that these impurities are arsenic impurities, they were not phosphorus, and we can give them an understanding where they are in the device in terms of depth. So this is a longer part of a presentation, but my point is we were able basically to do metrology on their device with a million atom simulation, even on single impurity type devices. And these are shallow impurities, right? Phosphor, arsenic. And this, so basically a loosely bound electron does feel about a million atoms. Okay? And that the disorder around that will again matter. All right. So, million atom electronic structure, yes, we can do some of that, and we can explain actually experiments with that. And we do that on a day-to-day basis in my group now, where we run 10 million atom calculations on a day-to-day basis. So the next thing is, this is all electronic structure. Can we do with transport? So I'm going back to this example here. Now we really want to do transport, not just equilibrium problems. And what I had shown you earlier is basically a 1D heterostructure where we had transport. And here we have electronic structure for a million atoms. We want to put this together to allow transport in 3D geometries. So here's one example of, this is actually a 2D geometry of a modern field effect transistor that's being evaluated at MIT and built at MIT. This is a indium arsenide channel with indium gallium arsenide barriers, and then a dielectric around the indium aluminum arsenide. This device is large, 400 nanometers long, some 100 nanometers tall. It's a multi-scale simulation you need to do. You need to do the strain in the system in a very large domain. Then you can cut down your Poisson or electrostatic domain, and then you cut down further your quantum transport domain in the middle, and you treat source and drain and current here in the contacts as resistors, but you focus on the central quantum transport domain. And if you do that, you can, number one, look at the lattice constant along the channel of the device, and it's not smooth. You can look across the channel at the gate here, and it's also not smooth here, and it's actually different from a continuous prediction of what the lattice constant might be. And if you do all that and combine it with experiment, you can actually overlay experiment and theory very nicely. So this is an example where you can do transport, quantum transport, in a device that has some 40,000 atoms and has quite some spatial extent in full atomistic calculations. And again, the punchline here is what I want to mention is we didn't adjust any of the tight binding or valence force field parameters beforehand. I mentioned in the abstract that I'd like to talk a little bit about band-to-band tunneling devices. One of the fundamental issues with transistors these days is that they turn off too slow. There's actually a fundamental limit of turning from on to off at 60 millivolt per decade at room temperature. That has to do basically with the thermal extent of the carriers above the barrier here. And that's a fundamental limit. You can't turn off the device faster. You like to reduce the voltage over which you turn off a device because that's where your power is being lost. So the alternative idea is that you look at a band-to-band tunneling device where the thermal tail that you might have in your emitter in the traditional device is actually cut off by a band edge. So you actually define the energy window in which your carriers are flowing. And what we want to do is look at different designs and different materials. And the biggest challenge here really is, since this is a tunneling device, you like to have this on current as high as possible, and tunneling is exponentially dependent. And how do you control that? And then we want to have a steep sub-threshold swing, so we want to turn this off as fast as possible And we'd like to have the off current as low as possible. So we can do this as a challenge in this new Ullmann code. And we can do this for different materials. We can do this for indium antimonide, for graphene, or broken gap materials. We have the full atomistic band structure in there that couples the bands. We can do this with different geometries, like a double gate or single gate or gate all around nanowire. And we can do this for complicated device geometries and even start to include phonon scattering in these devices. So I'm just going to rush over these pretty fast. There's been a proposal out there to do a tunneling transistor. It was called a GFET green tunneling transistor by Chen-Ming Hu. And they did some simulations where proposed that if you make the gap very small in these devices and you have actually current flow that is vertical into this pocket and out rather than just straight through in this lateral, you can get very steep sub-threshold swing and you can get a big current, but it has never been experimentally shown. And I'd like to show you why, because really what you have is if you model this device, you have a very strong on current, but you have also a very strong off current. The device basically doesn't turn off. And the reason is that in the on state, everything happens just fine. Currents flow from here into the pocket and out. But in the off state, they just linger around here on the bottom, tunnel straight through. So you have a leakage path through the device. And that leakage path is spatially inhomogeneous. So instead of shutting off, basically you have electrons tunneling straight through. So we came up with an idea on how to push that. We push up this oxide and basically block it. And if we do that, we can actually get the device to turn off. We increase the on current and we're much better than the original proposal. And literally this week we filed the patent for this. That was enabled by simulation and by insight before the experiment. Right. So that tool is also extremely computationally intensive. In fact, it's so intensive we can run it on the biggest supercomputer in the world, up to 220,000 processors. So if you're into parallel computing, what you like to do is you want to reduce your compute time by a factor of 2 if you double your CPUs, and by 2 again if you double again, right? So on a log-log scale, that's a straight line. This code scales about as parallel efficient as it gets. There's about 8 codes in the world that do that, that run on the biggest machine in the world that can actually do that. So it's quite an achievement by Mathieu Loisier and my group to do that. And there's actually 3 machines in the U.S. that we have access to that we use all the time. So here's the biggest machine with about 225,000 cores. There's another at 64,000 cores and another one at 95,000 cores. And we run on those for the high-end calculations often. So, as an answer to the question, can we simulate transport in a million atoms? Not sure yet. We're close, but really this K3 of making good design choices, we already can do. We can file patents and do good design choices. Finally, I'd like to show you a little bit about online simulation and what it can do for research. And I'd like to highlight this website, nanohop.org. And normally I would do an online sort of demo, and I can do that. But this is I'm going to show you a 4-minute video that actually shows it rather compact. And if you don't know about NanoHub, so this is a very simple way. This is also posted on YouTube, and actually Michael McLennan voiced this over. So I'll do it like this.
Imagine a technology that helps you explore a new area of science. And not only download resources, but learn from leading researchers online. Not with blurry videos, but through animated seminars where you can hear the speaker talk and clearly see his slides, where you can search for concepts and get right to the point. Imagine having fingertip access to simulation tools
that are easy to launch. Tools with intuitive controls that are well documented. And results that are readily visualized. And not just one tool, but dozens of tools that simulate many different phenomena. Tools that are not just Java applets, but real research codes that are connected to national grid resources. If you have questions about the results or the underlying models, imagine being able to ask experts throughout the world. Or being able to add your voice to the rest of the community. Imagine a new way of publishing. Where you can upload your own resources to share with others. To build your reputation or as outreach for your grant. Stop imagining. The cyber infrastructure of the future is here today. NanoHub.org, serving thousands of users for more than 3 years.
Right, so this is as fast as I can overview NanoHub, really. Of interest are a couple of tools probably for you if you teach people semiconductors. There's like crystal viewers, band structure, calculators, PN junction type things, MOSFET type things. They're lumped up into a tool suite we call Abacus to teach semiconductors. There's another tool suite that has quantum mechanics in it. So here's resonant tunneling, here's quantum.lab, here's confinement states, MOSFET type things. So those might be interesting for you for teaching right away. I'm going to show you a couple more stats. These are just raw stats. We're all at the top 50 US engineering schools, really users all over the world. But these are some stats, right? These are just raw numbers. In terms of 8,600 users running over 300,000 simulations in the last 12 months. We know from self-registration, it's been used by 116 classes at 97 institutions in the last year. And we know from Google Scholar that there's 575 citations in the literature that cite NanoHub as a tool. But these are some things, but we have a bunch of questions still. So how many students are in a class? What tools do they use? Is it an intensity of the use? What is it sustained? And are you using it for research and education, and by how much? So, and if we could answer these, we can get a better tool classification, we can maybe customize the learning experience and really broaden the user base. So, I'm sure you've seen the movie The Matrix, right? So we have, in a sense, a matrix as well. And we have a computer system through which simulations run through. I'm gonna dim the light here further. So, So here what we have is time in days, and each line is a user, okay? And you see a little speck mark of activity on a particular tool. And I'm going to animate this looking backwards in time. And what you'll see is the NanoHub matrix running through, and it seems like a bunch of uncorrelated specks until you see some streaks running through. Right here, there's a streak in blue, streak in green. Here's double streaks, big groups, even bigger groups of people that behave very similar. So you can ask yourself, how similar do they behave? You can correlate their behavior, and here are some of the answers. So here are some things we find, right? There is a classroom use in single tools, single time, like a single homework. Here, sustained tool, single use, but intense. Now, multiple tools, different colors, in periods of homework assignments, like week. Then small group of people, different tools. And we also see sort of research or self-study, meaning completely uncorrelated usage. What the power of NanoHub is that we enable scientists to not deal with a web developer to create sort of a facsimile of their own tool and hand it over. We take out this middleman and we allow scientists to put their own codes up there, engineers and scientists, without any web development knowledge. And that is true for vendors as well. And most scientists don't have user interfaces, so we have a way to create these user interfaces. And they look fancy and complicated, but this interface was built by an undergraduate in a week. So we have a technology to build that, and we can build it rapidly, and you don't have to rewrite your code. So if you like Fortran, that's fine. C, Python, Perl, MATLAB. We can ingest any of those codes and deploy them. To give you an idea how important the user interface is, this is how we used to do it since about 1995 with web forms. Here's a tool called Shred, and you see basically 8 users per month using it, a couple of poor suckers in the classroom that had to do some homework assignment. And I say poor suckers because they didn't come back, right? It didn't change how they did their work. And then we introduced these new interfaces that are interactive. You can view your results nicely, and our usage went up by a little bit, like by a factor of 6. On that particular tool. What's even more striking is that the number of source code downloads plummeted to nothing, or virtually nothing. It's not that we don't allow people to download the source code anymore, but people aren't interested in downloading source codes. So the point is, usability is a key, and we see that with about the 20 tools we converted from the old system to the new. Right? So usability is key if you want to have impact. And speaking of impact, I want to show you that we have impact on research. So here's a social network chart of the 575 papers that have been published. Most of them are outside the inner circle of the NCN. 56% of the papers are outside. You can sort of see that there's social networks forming. And I can color them slightly differently as well, where I can color them by papers that include experimental data or that are written by experimentalists. And the point is there's networks of experimentalists that are forming outside the NCN and inside that are using NanoHub, which is exactly what we wanted to achieve. We wanted to put simulation tools in the hands of people that normally wouldn't use it. So that was a key element we wanted to achieve with NanoHub. So that's a good start. The next question is, how good is this? How good are these citations, right? So we have about 575 NanoHub citations in the literature. They have 3,200 secondary citations. And if you don't know what an H-index is, roughly here is a sketch of a postdoc and a person in the field that's well-respected. So NanoHub has an H-index of 27. So if you consider NanoHub being a key contributor to the paper, it actually delivers science just like a relatively senior person, and NanoHub as such is only 8 years old since its first citations. So can online simulation enhance learning and research? I think we now have strong evidence for that. So those were the questions I tried to pose and some of the answers I tried to give. So I'll be happy to take some more questions. Yep.
So I may just ask actually on other things like these topics.
Yeah.
On an online simulation, where is the simulation actually being done? On the person who put the thing on?
Or no, it's done on a central machine, or if needed, it gets shipped to some other remote machine. So everything is hosted in a central service, in a sense. Yeah.
Related question to what Mike asked earlier on the alloy disorder step.
Yeah.
So you cannot actually predict what kind of disorder will form.
I throw dice, right? I throw a weighted dice. Yeah. I mean, I have different alloy models. I can throw the dice for every atom. I can throw the dice for a unit cell. So I have some clustering.
But the thing, you don't have to take experiments and measure like an image as input.
I could.
You don't have to. Even from your own generator, you predict something.
Yeah, that's right.
But you put it by hand.
Right. I mean, I would love to have actually either better measurements or actually a real growth simulator, right, that really predicts what the local order might be, right? But there is no such thing. I mean, the people that model growth say, well, let me assume that this lattice is cubic. Well, things I'm interested in are zinc blender, mostly, or diamond.
Or
Wurzite. Yeah.
It wasn't clear for me if phonon scattering was included in your transport simulations. It's pretty important for QCLs.
Yeah, it's very important for QCLs. So for the QCL simulator we have, it's included in the NEMO 1D. That is what I worked on for like a year and a half or two until we understood that really the band structure effects are much more important for the high temperature devices. So NEMO 1D has polar optical phonons, acoustic phonons, alloy disorder, interface roughness scattering, and they all for RTDs turn out to be completely irrelevant for high temperatures. But QCL is different. You build in phonons as part of the transport. Different story, different device. Nick, you had a question. You wrote it down, right?
I remember it though, but this is peripheral to nano, but I'll ask it since you mentioned at the beginning, but 2 billion transistors on a chip now and so on. How many of them actually work? I mean, I can't imagine all 2 billion work, so there must be some redundancy built in or some way of dealing with that in these chips.
I don't think there's a whole lot of redundancy in there. There's so much margin built into the transistor design that if a transistor works on the margin, it's still the whole circuit works. And then they have vast testing of chips, right? So for example, when you buy a 3.0 gigahertz chip, right, that thing tested out and validated for 3.0 gigahertz. The same product you might buy in as a 2.2 gigahertz chip, it just didn't function to 3.3.
The memory chips had the correction circuit built in, right?
But that's different.
They are allowing for that.
Right.
To get to the millions of electrons, you must have, of course, a limited set of orbitals you allow per atom,
yeah,
right? So you have to have some...
Yeah, it's SP3*D5.
So therefore, anything which requires some Ds or anything like that, which are more complicated materials, of course it would. But so if you thought about doing something for different material but a smaller scale, because really to simulate millions of electrons, you really in general you don't need it to the extent that if you want to understand something, if you do 1,000 electrons probably.
Well, actually everything we do in a sense is actually in a single electron picture.
No, but I understand that. But talk about the number of potential
So
don't really need millions to extract a feature possibly, right?
Well, it depends on the feature. I mean, my point on the single impurity, you would think, well, that's, single impurity, what do you need? But if you have strain and distortion, that single electron that's bound to a single phosphor or arsenic impurity sees about 1 million atoms. And you can see if you make the domain smaller, you can see the eigenstates of the system move. So it sees the edge and it sees the confinement of your artificial box. So it explores about 1 million atoms. on a shallow impurity. A deep impurity will be different. Yeah?
There are now many X hops now possible.
Right, 30.
How many?
30.
Okay, so how easy it is to create hop? They're just copying similar technology. There's a template.
Yeah, actually, Hub Zero, the technology, is now open source. You can actually download it for free. You can operate it. Most of those 30 hubs are operated here at Purdue, and they're operated for centers that have the need for a hub. But it's open source. You can download it. You can host it yourself. Any other questions? Must be clear.
Let's thank our speaker again.
Thanks.